Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 5th of October, as we record, mere moments after the award of this year's Nobel Prize for Literature. Sadly, the fine team at Investors Chronicle has been overlooked once again, but we will persevere nonetheless. Coming up today, we discuss full year results from the perhaps underappreciated heating and ventilation provider Volution. We look at this week's cover story, which is all about the pesky and persistent discounts to net asset value on which investment trusts are trading this year. We'll ask what can be done and where the real bargains may lie for investors. And to conclude, we discuss the big issue in markets over the past month. That's the renewed spike in bond yields in the US and therefore in the UK and elsewhere too. We'll debate what, if anything, that might mean for shares in the months ahead. Joining me to discuss all of this here in the studio are Alex Newman.
Hi, Dan.
Also joining me in the studio, Val Cipriani.
Hi, Dan.
And Mike Fahey.
Hello.
Mike, we'll begin with you.
Okay.
You covered the results for Volution. Mm-hmm. Again, the Nobel Committee overlooked you disappointingly this year. But nonetheless, those figures, I mean, the company has been under cosh a little bit this summer due to its exposure to the construction sector and the perceived, you know, weakness there and the actual weakness in terms of the end market. But today's results look pretty good.
Yeah, today's results were good. Revenue was up about 6%. Earnings were higher than expectations, about 3% beat to earnings per share. Good cash generation, and its net debt was lower than analyst forecasts as well. And overall, an all-round good performance. And I think the main reason for that is when we look at the building materials market, there's much of the woes are caused by the higher interest rates feeding into mortgage rates, which then means lower demand for new homes. But Volution was very sort of keen to stress that although new build is a sizable part of its earnings, it's only around a third, and most of its, well, maybe even slightly lower, going towards 30%, most of its earnings come from the kind of repair, maintenance, improvement market.
Yeah, and I mean, if we look at what's happened over the past few months, we can put that to aside for a minute, but what about the business itself, you know, the growth drivers there? There are concerns over these end markets, but where does Volution see business coming from? Where is it seeing business come from?
So it's got three prominent geographies, and it's been a serial acquirer, which I think we're going to get into. But yeah, it makes about half of its money from the UK, roughly, then about a third from continental Europe, and the rest from Australia. And I suppose the key thing is when you look at all of these markets, unusually, you would think that diversification is a good thing to have and would offer it some sort of protection. But this higher interest rate environment and the depressing effects it's had on housing is kind of global. So in all of them, it's faced similar sort of pressures in new build.
One thing you covered earlier in the year when you wrote about the company in our ideas section was, you know, the exposure to the UK social housing sector, which is a string to its bow, given the regulations there and the need to improve those properties. And that seems to have been borne out by these figures.
Yeah, sorry, I should have said, I talked about the three different markets, but the UK was actually the strongest performer this year, which seems counterintuitive when you look at some of the peers. But it is partly driven by that social housing demand. Last year there was a death of a young, there was a coroner's report about the death of a young boy, Awab Ishak, in a property in Rochdale, and his death was linked to mould and damp. And following that, the Levelling Up Secretary, Michael Gove, wrote to every social housing provider in the country saying, up your game, basically. So there's a much greater awareness of the problems of mould and damp, and more of an impetus to tackle it on the social housing providers. So that has clearly fed into Volution's results. But somewhat surprisingly, the private RMI market was, they described it as resilient as well. I think there's some frustration from the company's point of view in that they are seen as this, they're lumped in with all of the other building materials companies, which, you know, the people making bricks, etc. And their products, I think they would rather be seen alongside other heating and ventilation companies, such as the likes of Ariston in Italy and Systemair of Sweden. And there's quite a few players in Europe, but because there's no others in the UK, they're kind of lumped in with people, like I said, providing bricks, blocks, and maybe much lower margin businesses as well.
Mm. Yeah, we were talking about this yesterday, weren't we, when we were discussing, you know, the prospect of talking about Volution ahead of this morning's results. And we looked at the shares over the summer and they, you know, down, I think, 20% in 6 months for no particular company-specific reason, more that they've been lumped in with the construction sector and marked down for that reason.
Yeah, and people see housing markets, people see, you know, new build starts on homes falling, and although it is only a third, it's still a third, it's still a big driver. And if you're looking at that as somebody watching the market and you're looking at the companies with exposure, then Volution seems like an obvious target, really.
Yeah. Well, shares up 10% today, so, you know, clearly there was...
They were up 15% just before we came into the
15%,
studio.
There we are. So it's making back some of that ground, which was, you know, perhaps an unjustified fall.
Mm.
You talked a bit about margins there as well, and, the progression there, the targets, you know, plus 20% margins,
yeah,
still very much on track.
And it's slightly, kind of slightly edged up, the margin, which, given so many inflationary pressures, not only in terms of materials, but around wages and distribution, etc., is a fairly decent result. They indicated that towards the end of the year, and I think this is one of a couple of tailwinds for it, towards the end of the year, the inflationary pressures around the cost of parts and materials is easing somewhat, even though wages and lots of other input costs are still quite high.
And what about the headwinds aside from the end markets, or perhaps where those are manifesting as it stands? I think OEM was slightly less of a good performer this time around.
Yeah, it's OEM. They make something called, I can't remember what it is, impellers. They're this little part that fits onto the end of fans to distribute heat. And that is directly really they sell those to people selling into new build market. It's directly the new build market. And I asked about when they see a recovery in that, and it's basically when the new build market recovers, when interest rates come down. But what they did say is that they are using more of the products internally and trying to generate some demand that way.
Mm. Alex, do you have a view on Volution, its prospects?
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of its prospects, you have to say that the long-term structural drivers are really sound. And one way you can... You know, you can tell that this is a company that's a little bit detached from the construction cycle is that it's managed to grow profits and sales every year since it listed in 2014. So that's partly because of its kind of roll-up strategy, and it's also the way it's expanded globally. So that has allowed it to supplement the years where organic growth hasn't been quite as strong. But there's one part of the results I looked at today where it really jumped out. This is a well-run business. Is their cash conversion over the last year was 106%. I mean, it can seem like a minor point sometimes. We don't always get into cash conversion, but, you know, say they deliver £1 million worth of equipment to a housing association, one of their, you know, their big end markets now. If it takes 6 months for them to collect payment, then that's £25,000 that they've foregone in potential interest if it was held at the bank, or a much higher return if they'd ploughed that cash back into the business where demand is strong if they had been paid on day one. So, you know, they're obviously in every contract there are sort of hedges for this and ways of protecting, long payment times. But the fact is they are managing to book, they're managing to generate more cash than they are reporting in the income statement. And that's a really reassuring sign for investors. So, you know, you can tell from that the department tasked with collecting receivables has done a great job. And these kind of businesses, they are, you know, Volution is in a product selling business, it's in the ventilation business, but it's also in the money collection business. And those kind of margins and being able to do both are what really can add a lot of value and momentum to a company over the long term. So that really jumped out to me, and that's, you know, a real positive, I think, for the story.
I think on the cash part, there is one kind of slightly specific factor in that last year when there were supply chain issues all over the place, they were talking about deliberately stocking up and making sure they had as much inventory as possible, but the service provision and the ability to get product out to people was more important than maybe a few margin points. And that's kind of borne out. Well, they say that they have improved on market share as a result, but as supply chains have eased, some of that inventory is unwound, which has fed into that cash position you were talking about.
Final point on Volution, the acquisitions you mentioned at the top, Mike.
Yeah.
They are quite an acquisitive company. Maybe been a bit of a slowdown in the past 18 months, but some new deals still being announced. So they're still, you know, optimistic. They still have an international expansion strategy too.
Yeah, well, I did ask about this. They, whether or not there'd been something of a slowdown. And the chief exec, Ronnie George, pushed back slightly. He said, if you look over the course since we've been listed, they listed, it's almost 10 years ago now, in 2014, they've done around 2.5 deals a year. So they did two this last year. They've already done one this year. So maybe a slight slowdown, but nothing too drastic. And I was asking about the pipeline as well, and he said it was still strong. I think there's some frustration there in terms of valuations. You would think that in a market like this, which is much weaker, that there may be some more bargains to be had. But he was saying that vendors are obviously still, you know, nobody wants to drop prices. Vendors still playing hardball, and they are still paying around the same now, or they're still looking at paying around the same now than they have been through the cycle, about 7 to 10 times earnings.
Yeah. Well, it's worked for them so far, so they'll be backing themselves given the execution and the operational management skill we've seen to keep doing that. So we'll keep tabs on that as well. Our next section, though, is on our cover story this week, which is about investment trusts. If you hold any investment trusts, you will probably know that the issue of discounts to NAV is proving to be increasingly irksome for everyone involved in the sector, really. Val, you wrote this piece. The big question, what are the reasons for the persistence of these discounts? Because there's always times when, you know, trusts en masse or sector by sector trade at premiums or discounts, and, you know, quite often they tend to, you know, move around, but it's really been a one-way street over the past year, 18 months, and not in the right direction. So what are the drivers of this as far as we can ascertain?
Yeah, it has been lasting for a while at this point. I think everybody at first was hoping that it might be a bit of a hiccup, but it hasn't been so far. And I think one of the reasons is that there are a few things happening at the same time, and it's kind of hard to separate them. So high interest rates are definitely a factor, especially for trusts investing in unlisted assets, which at this point do make up quite a significant proportion of the sort of whole investment trust universe. So, you know, private equity, infrastructure and property are all impacted by interest rates, or although sometimes in slightly different ways. But in general, they tend to be quite leveraged assets, and also they are impacted by higher discount rates, which reduce the value of future cash flows. So investors are definitely worrying about whether the valuations that these trusts are using for their assets are accurate, and the sentiment has been quite negative. But I mean, in theory, this shouldn't apply, at least not in the same way, for equity trusts, not beyond what's already sort of priced in the underlying assets in the companies they invest in. But even though in this sector the discounts are somewhat bit less extreme, they're still quite strong, quite relevant. I think I was looking this morning, so as of the 4th of October, global equity trust sector, the average discount was 13.5%, so still pretty bad. And that's where some of the other factors come in that are not necessarily just related to sentiment or to the macro environment, but they sort of seem to reflect a bit of a lack in demand that the sort of everybody in the sector is maybe starting to find a bit more worrying. And one thing there is that those trusts, no matter what they sort of invest in or where they invest in, at the end of the day, they're listed in the UK, and most of them would be on the FTSE 250. And it's not a very loved market right now, obviously. So that does impact them. And then the other thing that everybody's sort of quite talking about quite a bit is what's happening with the wealth management industry, because they are big investment trust investors, have been for a long time, and the industry sort of consolidating. I mean, we had the deal between Investec and Rathbones, but there are also a lot of like smaller companies sort of merging together. And what happens there is that, you know, if there are bigger wealth managers, they also need bigger investment trusts that are more liquid and they can sort of trade easily in the volumes that they need. So for the smaller investment trusts, it's not generally great news. So yeah, a bunch of things.
Yeah, a lot of pressures. Of course, boards do have some tools in their arsenal to try and counteract this. The obvious, or perhaps the go-to in a lot of cases, is the share buyback. There's questions there, though, maybe about how effective they've been given the persistence of these discounts. There are also other things that boards can do as well, though.
Yeah, I think with buybacks, you know, there have definitely been more in the last year. And whether they work or not is sort of a big debate. That I think the framing now is it depends on what you expect them to do. So if you're hoping that buybacks will just totally close the discounts, it doesn't look like it's happening, no matter like how many shares the trusts do actually buy back. But generally speaking, there is this argument that they still support the NAV and they show that the board sort of believes in the underlying portfolio, because basically you're rebuying the same portfolio again if you're buying back shares. So they sort of like, you know, they're a sign that there is sort of commitment from the board to sort of like support the shareholders and get good returns for them. But yeah, by themselves, it doesn't look like they're very likely to manage to close the discount. And in terms of like what else could be done, so there's a few things. One big one for the smaller trusts especially is looking at mergers and acquisitions. So for some of them, merging together, for others, whether, you know, just thinking about whether they should sell the assets, really. And there has been quite an uptick in M&A activity in the sector, and I think everybody is expecting more. Also because, as we were saying, there is demand for bigger and more liquid trusts, and partly also because over like the previous years, there were really a lot of investment trusts launching sometimes, and sometimes, you know, quite a few of them sort of doing similar things. So in some cases, it just sort of makes sense that there will be a few less. And then the other thing that could potentially be interesting is that there are a few trusts for now that sort of have facilities where the investors can regularly get their investment back at sort of NAV value rather than at share price value. So, for example, Diverse Income Trust does this every year, just once a year. If you want, you can get your money back. And I think it will be interesting to see if the discounts continue, if more trusts would be willing to do this, to kind of like give investors the opportunity to get their money back closer to the real value of the assets.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose it's a sad situation in some ways where you have to accommodate people who, I mean, it's understandable, but it's sad that the situation has boiled down to, well, the best I can hope for is getting money back at par rather than any appreciation. But given how long some of these discounts have been going on, there would be some people, you know, who would have that interest. And as you say, perhaps that could promote a better, you know, sentiment on those trusts overall and contribute to improvement in future. One thing we did as part of the piece is look at trusts' Z scores, because clearly with this persistence of discounts, a big discount doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to close up and doesn't necessarily mean that the buying opportunity is going to be one that is realized anytime soon. So we've looked at Z scores in an attempt to rank some of these trust discounts relative to their history and pick out some of the most yawning of those discounts.
Yeah, we've got nice little table in the magazine that you can look at. But basically, it looks at trusts that are trading at pretty big discounts, that have not been doing too bad performance-wise in the past year, and that pay dividends and are not overly geared, so they don't have too much debt. And we've ordered them by their Z-score, which basically, again, tells you whether a trust is especially cheap compared to how it's been in the past year or so. And I think the most interesting thing that came out of that table is that in the top 20 results, there were really quite a few infrastructure trusts, both sort of in the renewable energy space and in the more sort of core infrastructure side. And I think it's quite interesting because also infrastructure is an area that everybody tends to cite when you ask them about which of these discounts could potentially be opportunities, just because it really, really has derated a lot off the back of higher interest rates. And so, you know, for investors who are prepared to be a bit patient and kind of like look into it, there really might be something in there somewhere.
Yeah. These are the kind of trusts, of course, that do suffer, as you say, from higher rates and you know, the bond yield spike, which we'll come on to in a moment of recent weeks, hasn't helped them either. But perhaps that just makes the opportunity more attractive in some ways, because operationally, you know, a lot of these portfolios are still performing pretty well, it seems. Alex, I just want to bring you in again here, because you've also written about investment trusts in the magazine this week. A lesson from history in some ways.
Yeah, I suppose it's in the context of wondering if you're an investment trust holder, you know, whether you should really worry about the discount, because, you know, all things being equal, you're still hoping your managers, you know, can give you some income and capital appreciation, even if the market is being pessimistic. You know, over time, if you're a long-term holder, your hope will be that things are either correct or things are rising anyway, so you don't have to worry about you know, the short term and the need to buy back shares. The issue with that, though, is that discounts are in a way a negative for investment trusts in and of themselves, because what it does is it prevents them from issuing equity at NAV or at a premium to NAV, which has been over a lot of the low interest rate post financial crisis decade. That was a real possibility, and particularly in the real estate investment trust, if they're in a hot sector. You know, just looking back 2 years ago, Big Yellow, the self-storage investment trust, sold 100 million pounds of shares at a 45% premium to NAV. Today, their shares trade at a 25% discount to NAV. Clearly, they couldn't do what they did 2 years ago without causing significant dilution to shareholders. Because, you know, why would you, you know, if you were a new investor, why would you agree to buying shares at a 25% markup to the current market? Anyway, the point there is that it has raised the cost of capital for investment trusts, and so not only is debt more expensive, but equity markets are a lot harder to tap. Yeah, I suppose the reason this is a lesson from history is that the hedge fund luminary and philanthropist George Soros pointed this out quite a long time ago, and he was watching a real boom period in what were then called mortgage trusts in the late 60s and early 70s in the US, and he saw that there was this really powerful incentive for investment trusts to issue equity at premium, because that just juiced the earnings per share, and so long as you were on that gravy train, it could run for quite a while. Until that is that the earnings started to slow in the business, as you know, almost every sector has seen earnings slow down in the last two years, and then sentiment drops, and then it leads to the opposite, which is a kind of spiral in sentiment and you know, quite a long fall. So the sort of lessons there is that these can be quite long cycles, and a correction in NAV is something that investors might want to see before they actually get bullish about some of the investment trust world, because sentiment, you know, as Val said, it is such a part of the investment case for investment trusts, whether or not, you know, you take a very agnostic view on discounts. So yeah, that was just the small addendum to Val's brilliant piece.
On that subject of, you know, the catalysts and you know, for certain sectors and certain trusts, it will take, I'm sure, you know, a change in overall sentiment, or at least a end to yields and interest rates rising, which, well, one of those has ended, but the bond yields are still rising at the moment. But there are obviously also idiosyncratic cases as well, and cases where, you know, trusts will see an improvement. I suppose we don't need to go into specific details right now as to which trust those might be, but I think that's a fair point, is it, Val, that, you know, we're not entirely dependent on the macro situation turning for an improvement in all discounts.
Yeah, no, I think it's probably a case of just being quite careful and selective of the investment trust you kind of choose to invest in. So, well, the general idea is that, just as we said before, just because it's discounted and it's cheap, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's attractive. But still, there are trusts that, because of various issues that they might have had, or for other reasons, they do look particularly cheap and they have decent hopes of sort of like picking up a little bit again. So it's this idea, you know, that some trusts do have sort of catalysts waiting for them in the next months or so. And there could be some opportunities for investors there, even if the sort of general economic environment doesn't get any better.
Yeah. And conversely, as Alex said, you know, if these are opportunities for the long term as well, you know, you can pick up a good dividend yield and bank on, you know, the operational performance giving you capital growth over the long term, then all will be well ultimately. Indeed. For the short term, though, we're turning to a situation that has been alarming some people. We've mentioned it many times already on this brief show, and that is bond yields. There's been a bit of a rally today, but prior to that, we have seen a big surge in yields and therefore a fall in bond prices. Of course, it was this time last year that something similar happened in the UK, and we all know the reason for that. That was the mini budget. This time around, though, the catalyst may be a little less clear, Alex.
Yeah, so I suppose, which we have also talked on this podcast quite a few times before, there's been this tug of war of the past year. So at the end of 2022, there was a huge amount of commentary, including in our magazine and also market positioning, that that suggested investors thought this was going to be an excellent year for bonds, because the anticipation was that interest rates and inflation were peaking, economies were starting to slow, and that bond prices would, after a disastrous year, would rally. And that didn't happen because interest rates, as we now know, went higher than expected. The outlook for falling inflation has been a lot more mixed, and some of the economic data, particularly out of the US, has been a lot more robust than anyone anticipated. And then pouring more fuel on that fire, the Fed, which really is kind of the rate setter for this entire market, has been quite hawkish. So it's kind of come out and said it's not about to reward markets with a nice pat on the back and say, you know, all's well now, yields can fall. So there's been this holding pattern ever since, where the bond trade continues to look good, but the fundamentals are taking a lot longer to be proven right. So another way of saying that is that the analysis has just been wrong because the timing's been too early. And what might be spiking yields, which have really just been rising, if you take a longer term view, not just the past couple of weeks, they've really just been, you know, they've been continually rising over the last year plus, is that, you know, the latest bout might have just been capitulation because you know, investors are starting to have to recalibrate the pace of rate cuts. And there's so much hinges on the timing of getting it right, of calling the top of the rate cycle. Now there's this, you know, this muddy picture. Are they going to stay elevated for longer? And there's all the technical reasons why it might not just be that. And there's also, you know, there's sort of premier and adjustments in various, you know, treasury lengths, which might be affecting, which I have to say, I don't fully understand the various competing theories there. What makes sense to me is that it's a very long-term and painful adjustment. We might just be seeing the latest iteration of that.
Yeah. I mean, the two things, I suppose, I would say the first is it's clear whatever's driving the bond yield spike, that is definitely driving renewed pressure on equities in recent weeks.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that some of these explanations are maybe a little contradictory, because you've got, yeah, you know, term premium, which is the gap or proportional gap between the long end of the curve and the short end, which we won't go into now. But you've also got things like, you know, there's some people saying, well, they're pricing in better growth rates, and some people are saying, well, actually, it's because people are actually finally starting to price in a recession in the US. So, you know, entirely contradictory. Nonetheless, all of this recent move, because obviously with interest rates rising, this has been going on at a more gradual pace for a while, but this recent move does seem to at least have been sparked by the Fed decision, or at least their dot plots last month, where they indicated that, you know, rates weren't going to be cut anytime soon, which to me, and I think to a lot of people, is an obvious point, but markets really hadn't priced, or it seems like they hadn't really priced that in. They were still expecting a lot of rate cuts, you know, much sooner than you and I might think. Of course, who knows, if this gets really bad, then maybe those rate cuts will materialise out of panic, but let's hope we don't get to that situation. I mean, the ultimate point of all this discussion really, though, is to look as well about what the implications could be. Clearly, 6 months ago or so, we had a US, you know, mini banking panic based on the fact that a lot of banks were, and still are, you know, holding bonds. They're holding them to maturity, but they had to mark them to market in some cases, and that, you know, left them nursing big losses. And then we saw what happened with Silicon Valley Bank and people getting worried about regional banks. I suppose the initial thought is, would this latest increase run the risk of a repeat of that kind of situation, albeit one where you'd hope people are a bit more cognizant of the various supports and at least the situation, rather than this being a new issue?
Yes, in short. I think you kind of gave a very good half answer at the end of there. But what I've read is that, you know, the very big unrealized losses on US banks' balance sheet. So they own hundreds of billions of government bonds, which contribute to the way their capital is calculated. They're still there, and they've now booked larger unrealized losses. And I mean, fortunately, most of that is held to maturity, so they're not forced sellers of that capital or that debt. But as we saw in March with the blow up of Silicon Valley Bank and others, the impression of any issue with a bank's capital or balance sheet has unintended and very serious consequences, which, you know, everything can unravel very, very quickly. European banks, it looks like, are a little bit more insulated, in part because they reduced their exposure to bonds. But I mean, the lesson, you know, from the beginning of this year, and it wasn't that long ago, is that in moments of crisis, you know, emotion can really take over. And, you know, obviously in the case of Silicon Valley, it was a bit idiosyncratic because of the nature of the deposited base there, and the bank run was kind of exacerbated by the business structure. But, you know, in moments of crisis, you know, and we've, you know, got, it looks like we've got a big issue with Metro Bank this week as well, it becomes very hard to assign probability to outcomes. So you get massive sell-offs in equity prices and these sort of jumps in markets. So yeah, don't rule it out is, I think, has to be the watchword.
Yeah. And of course, even though in that case, it was pretty US concentrated, aside from the tangential fall of Credit Suisse, you know, these concerns, as you say, do reverberate around markets, albeit, you know, even in the months since then, in case of UK banks, you know, there hasn't really been any deposit flight. So there isn't that kind of fundamental concern there, partly because those banks are so big already. There are, though, you know, other sectors have been affected. UK insurers, we've spoken about a bit in recent weeks, partly because of the dividend yields already on offer there, and the valuations looking relatively bombed out. They've been hit a bit again this week, like the investment trust we talked about, because of the increase in, you know, in some ways in discount rates and the way these things ripple around. Utilities in the US have been quite badly hit. Over here, not so much. That's partly because, you know, the water sector has had new investment plans. So I suppose it always comes down to those fundamentals. It does always seem in situations like this, though, that we can talk about what's happened in recent weeks and months, and then the pinch point will always be something which no one, despite our best efforts, has really identified. So, you know, the lesson is maybe the unknowns are the ones to really watch out for, insofar as that's a lesson, which is not helpful at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, to mangle the metaphor, you know, this is a grey rhino event in that it's been emerging for, you know, it's something we know about and we can see, and there are ways to address it in advance, but we might not be doing enough about it. But the, you know, the catalyst for a crisis might be a black swan style hiccup or some liquidity event in the financial plumbing, which is very, very hard to get a read on from the outside until it hits. So it could be a hedge fund blow up. You don't know when things are moving dramatically. These are all possibilities.
Equally, it could all turn out to be fine and a great buying opportunity.
Yeah,
you know, we don't want to, I suppose, go head over heels straight into it now, because some people have been making some, you know, doomy comparisons with previous years this week. But one comparison I saw was with the taper tantrum in 2013, again, a similar thing sparked by Fed's, well, indication from Bernanke at the time that they were stopping bond buying. That was quickly righted by the Fed. I'm not sure we can necessarily expect them to step in this time so quickly. However, that was a situation where, you know, there was a lot of concern about rising bond yields, and ultimately it kind of came out in the wash. So we shall see. As I often like to say on this show, you know, it's difficult to it's impossible to predict the future, isn't it? But nonetheless, we should be aware of these risks and the possibility that it will all turn out to be fine.
Yeah.
On that note, I'm going to conclude. We have run out of time, but thank you very much to Alex, to Val, and to Mike. And thank you to you for listening. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.